So what do you want to talk about this week, Wolf?
Stream Control Transmission Protocol, or SCTP.
Very good. We had a bit of trouble trying that before.
Yeah, I just really stumbled over myself first time. I had to redo the call.
Alrighty. So, and before we get to that, a little bit of follow-up. I have a few web pages here. Regarding episode 102, The Grubby Particulars of the Hardware, I talked about size classes. I have since found an article called Adaptive Layouts for iPhone 6 by Matthew Sanders, which has a lot of stuff in it. But in particular, the thing that interested me was he made an actual grid, a visual grid, which showed which actual devices of the new devices that have come out belong to which size class in which dimension. And it really does just highlight how little information the new size classes give you, how they really don't give you enough information to write a new app with it. So that was interesting. I'll put that in there. Second one was about talking about SpriteKit in 106, FlappyKit. Mm-hmm. And I had heard rumors before I gave that topic that SpriteKit was based on an existing game library. But I stopped putting it together when I couldn't find anything else more about it. And I still haven't found anything official about it. But someone did mention to me today that they had heard at the WWDC when it was announced that it was basically a port of the Cocos 2D and Box 2D frameworks. Mm-hmm. And again, I can't find anything official on it. The closest I can come is a post on cocos2d-swift.org where they say SpriteKit based on Cocos 2D ? And nobody ever really comes out and says that it's based on it, but people do kind of go back and forth and say, well, it seems likely that it's based on it. Mm-hmm. So I think it does change things a bit for it to be a port of existing code rather than something that Apple made when it was new. Because, you know, by doing that, you're sort of starting with legacy code. And trust me, I've been there. I know what it's like to be in that sort of situation. But it does limit what you can do with the code base because it was written, you know, so it was written to support earlier versions of the OS, for example. It was written way before Metal. So it doesn't necessarily completely align with Apple's technological goals. So that does add, I think I might actually be less likely to use it. For my stuff, if I had been sure of that, because again, I'm using legacy code to write my app now.
I'm also wondering that maybe they didn't fork the existing code base, but they might use it as basically a kind of a design spec, kind of like how should this stuff work.
That's not generally how Apple works. If they're basing it on something in order to get the benefits of not having to write it from scratch, they really base it on it. Now, extending it. They've added more support for, I think, what is it? Core
animation?
Not core animation, like core image, the filters.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So more iOS and OS X specific stuff, but that's extending what's there already rather than rewriting the engine. So it's a little bit of extra information.
Yeah, I believe the Cocos stuff, I mean, the name kind of makes it sound like it's maybe started off on Cocos, but I think it started off in Python or something. And
no, Cocos is a city. Los Cocos, something like that. It does nothing. The name has nothing to do with Cocos.
Right. Good point. Yeah. But I'm pretty sure it started off as a language that was, I know did not initially exist with the Objective-C portion. Yep. That had to be ported over. So, I mean, that does kind of tell you that maybe the design wasn't geared towards, optimized towards Objective-C. So, yep. I don't know. I wouldn't discount the idea that Apple didn't just maybe write their own, but use it as a design spec. I know you don't like this idea, but that's my vote.
Okay. All right.
Okay, so the topic at hand, Stream Control Transmission Protocol. So when you're writing internet apps, basically the two protocols that we're used to dealing with is TCP and UDP. So TCP deals with streams. And so you kind of, let's say, basically have this unlimited bit stream that you can shove bytes into, and bytes come out the other end on the remote process, and vice versa. And the problem with that is that it's... Well, of course, TCP is obviously a total success, right? I mean, it's everything except what we're talking over right now, which is Skype, which is actually running over UDP. But pretty much everything else on the internet tends to run over TCP. So it's really a fantastic success story. But that said, it's not tend to be too well geared for the applications that it's not directly geared for the applications we tend to write. We tend to want to do kind of messages type stuff. And because TCP is basically like this endless byte stream type thing, that means you have to manually frame things. So you basically have to say, okay, I'm sending you this chunk of data. So now I'm not going to, I'm going to first write out how many bytes you're going to read, before you know you got the entire message, and then I'm going to send the message and stuff like that. You have to do this manual framing. And TCP, even for its wild success, it has some issues here in terms of like its general packet design, which is complicated, and it is it's susceptible to a certain type of denial of service attack called SYN flooding, for synchronization packet flooding. And so if you don't need the overhead of TCP, and TCP is really great in terms of like reliable byte stream, and also in terms of latency, but that's what UDP is good for. So I'll just jump to UDP. UDP doesn't, we've all heard the same Twitter joke over and over and over again, right? It was funny the first 10, 24 times.
Oh, I still laugh at it.
But the UDP stands for User Datagram Protocol. A lot of people think it stands for Unreliable Datagram Protocol. Might as well. The idea is that it's basically one level up above IP itself. And if we're doing things like Skype, and so audio will have this thing where if a packet gets dropped, you don't really want to have to spend too much time trying to resend it, because by the time you can actually negotiate a resend, by the time you can actually play that audio, the window of time that is relevant has passed. So you can try retransmission, and it might arrive time, but oftentimes you have to keep on chugging along. So kind of like building kind of real-timey protocols on top of internet stuff, you tend to use UDP for that type of stuff. Of course, UDP has a bunch of problems. Number one, it's unreliable because it doesn't guarantee this reliability that TCP has. It's not part of the spec. That's out of its scope, and that's why it's good for things like real time, because that's not part of its scope. And a lot of people then, the nice thing is it's kind of packety, that you can shove things in packets. Problem is, it's not really message oriented. That if it comes where you have one message that has to span multiple packets, maybe because it's bigger than the maximum size packet, IP packet, then you're going to have to figure out your own fragmentation mechanism and then bundle it up. And then what happens if the second packet arrives or the first one didn't and stuff like that. So then you have to do your own resend algorithm. And the thing with TCP is that it has a really tried and true resend algorithm that is kind of sucky that you have to give it up, because this is what TCP is built for. So it's kind of weird that like these two protocols that dominate the internet really aren't good for the apps we tend to write. And so neither is really optimal. And that's why I've been interested in Stream Control Transmission Protocol for basically since it came out, maybe before. I can't remember whether I heard about it before it hit the final RFC or if I got into it later. But anyway, I've been following it for over a decade. And I really would hope it ends up getting more widespread support, because I think it's pretty cool. Number one is that it's message oriented. So instead of having to have this byte stream that you frame your messages yourself, the API to HTTP itself, you say, here, I'm sending this message, and it does the fragmentation for you and the framing and the reassembly on the other side of the process across the network.
So it breaks it up for you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it basically is kind of like this kind of hybrid between TCP and UDP. That so the stream should give you a hint that it's essentially a way to do a pretty performant way. I don't know if it's really a slam dunk for things like Skype, but in terms of like really pure audio plays or something like that. But it's a lot more real time than TCP, and a lot more streamy, especially because it's message oriented. That it does something that's called multi-streaming. And I'll read from the RFC 4960 here. TCP provides both reliable data transfer and strict order of transmission delivery of data. Some applications need reliable transfer without sequence maintenance, while others would be satisfied with partial ordering of the data. In both these cases, head-of-line blocking offered by TCP causes unnecessary delay. So header line blocking, I'll read from the Wikipedia entry here, is a computer networking term as performance limiting phenomena that occurs when the line of packets that is held up by the first packet, for example, input buffered network switches, out of order delivery, and multiple requests in HTTP pipelining. And this is loosely related to buffer bloat, which is kind of a problem with internet infrastructure. You know, we won't talk about here, but I encourage you to look into it. So multi-stream essentially allows HTTP to think about like how HTTP works over TCP. And it's a pretty good example that you send in the HTTP request and you get back the HTML. You extract everything you need from the HTML, which is probably maybe external CSS links, JavaScript links, images. And so you then have to serialize those requests to the HTTP server. What HTTP allows you to do is that the web server can actually send all those things simultaneously, that you don't have to serialize those and suffer the attendant overhead and overhead in the form of latency. Another really interesting thing about HTTP is that it's designed from the get-go to support multi-homing. So HTTP has this, it's based on, well, I don't want to say based on, but it has in its blood, in its heritage, it has, there's this thing called SS7, Signaling System 7, that is kind of, for the telecoms, for interoperation for telecom switches, stuff like that. Basically how the public switch telephone network system works. And so it has this idea that you kind of need to be able to support transparent failover so that if your IP address goes away or needs to change, that you know you still need to be able to place that call to 911. For non-Americans in the audience, that's our emergency number. So the cool thing about HTTP is that the IP you connect to at a session can change, and that's really fundamentally a different thing than what TCP and UDP can do. You'd have to, I guess, kind of like bolt those on top of that. And there is multi-homing TCP, but I don't know too much about that, so I won't speak to it. So it also supports point to multi-point transport. So if you have things where you're like trying to stream video to multiple other nodes, that's built into the protocol itself. You don't have to do with TCP and UDP, that tends to be you have to have n packets for n number of places you want to broadcast to. There are, you can do broadcasting if you're on a LAN, but if you're doing a wide area network, then you probably just are going to have to send that many more packets out. And of course, then you have, content distribution networks like Akami, as I don't even know if you say that correctly, but it's, in general...
I think it's Akamai.
Is Akamai, thank you. I thought I was saying that wrong. Yeah, but in general, HTTP is designed for this from the get-go in terms of resiliency and efficiency. And so it's really an awesome protocol. And if you actually go and look down how it's defined at the packet level, it's really elegant. It's more efficient than TCP, and yet it has a simpler packet structure itself. And in terms of how it lays out the internal packet structure, where you basically, it's kind of like, if I don't know if you know too much about how the QuickTime file format is, where you have these atoms, and then depending on what the atom is, you know how to interpret the rest. It's similar to that, where you read the byte, and you figure out what the byte is, and then you know how to interpret the next X number of bytes according to it. And they did, if you read the Wikipedia page on the structure of the packet, and you just kind of scroll from top to bottom, you don't have to take it all in, but it just makes so much sense in terms of, you're like, yeah, like this, it's all fits in very well together. I mean, and it's a protocol that takes advantage of that we've been running the worldwide networking here for, what, 40 years now? I don't even know how old NCP and TCP is. But it definitely looks back and it notices all the things that kind of we had to be patched on to TCP and UDP as things have gone on. And it takes those into account and with a design that's very orthogonal and very clean. And it's kind of interesting to have like this protocol. This I believe is accepted by IETF. I think it's IETF standard, and it's actually kind of weird to have this standard that's actually pretty clean, pretty nice. But now we get to the kind of the sad part, which is unfortunately it's because it's so clean and so nice, we can't have it. Even though it's all these things, there's no built-in support for it. For on OS X or iOS.
Well, it's late is the problem, right? We already had the networks, everything built out, which uses TCP.
Yes, but I mean, SCTP runs over IP, right? So we have IP networks. So SCTP in terms of network support is here already, and it's been here basically forever.
But you gotta rewrite all the servers, and you gotta have people install the new versions of servers that support it.
Sure. That's pretty much the issue here. You can tunnel SCTP over UDP, and that's actually probably the most common implementation right now. And sadly,
oh, ow, really?
Yeah, ow. Yeah. I mean, it's not so bad because UDP isn't that much more over IP itself. So. But it does definitely call to mind, there was this other thing called BEEP, for Blocks Extensible Exchange Protocol. And do you remember this thing from Apple way back when in the era of Mac OS 10.4 called XGrid?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Yes. I think there might even have been an Xcode angle there for a while. But maybe not, because Xcode. So basically,
people Xcode start with X.
There you go. I think it maybe starts with 10. 10 code, right? So XGrid was Apple's clustering solution. It came from some sort of development group for computation or something like that. It was when Apple was rolling out Xserves as the next hotness, and BEEP is actually pretty cool. It's basically kind of a meta protocol that runs on top of TCP, and it's kind of wants to be like the JSON to your data format or your XML to your data format. It's just like it by itself doesn't do anything, but it provides a structure for what you want to get done. And so XGrid end up using that as its transport mechanism. And BEEP is pretty nice and actually accomplishes much of the same thing that SCTP wants to accomplish in terms of it will provide the framing for you, it will provide the multiplexing and stuff like that. It's pretty nice. Unfortunately, it is at a higher level. And sadly, neither has actually taken off. So I guess that it wasn't really a benefit for BEEP. And I guess being a low level wasn't a benefit for SCTP either. So. But it was, so XGrid was introduced in 10.4, but now it's pretty much officially dead. I checked on it, and the Wikipedia page says it's no longer even included in 10.8. So Apple apparently has lost that religion. And so, bottom line, SCTP is really cool, and maybe 20 years from now we'll actually be able to use it.
Keep hope alive, Wolf.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, so for me, I'm going to talk about, what did I decide to call it? I'm going to call it Apple's luxury problem. That's not really exactly what it is, but but I'll get through it. My impression from the history of Apple, now I haven't done like exhaustive research on any of this, so some of it could be wrong, some of it could be not quite the right years, but I think the spirit of it is correct. I mean, Macs have always been considered to be expensive. Mm-hmm. When they were first introduced, they were wildly more than PCs were at that point. They didn't sell very well until people came up with a specific reason to actually use them. At that point, it was desktop publishing. So, okay, they cost more, but here's what you can do with them that you can't do anywhere else. So it's worth the extra cost. And Apple pretty much, as far as I remember, coasted on that for years and years and years. And they made great margins on their hardware for that long. Mm-hmm. But it didn't last. They didn't have success for that forever. Of course, in the mid-90s, Apple started to die. They started to dwindle in that they weren't making, people weren't buying their hardware anymore. And so everybody knows that that happened. And then everybody knows that Jobs turned it around when he came back. But when you think about it in terms of the high level, how did Apple turn it around? How did Apple start to get people buying their products again? Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't by slashing prices. It wasn't by making them more cost-effective. It was by gimmicks. You know, the iMac was basically a gimmick. Mm-hmm. It was basically, hey, here's a new style to justify spending more money for our stuff. Mm-hmm. Now, I could be wrong about exactly when, but it seemed like sometime after that happened, they actually did start to get competitive in laptop prices. Hmm. That for a while their iBooks were competitive with PC laptops. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but that gave me a lot of hope. That's like, okay, Apple's coming back. Apple is finally getting around to making competitive hardware, because that seemed like always something they would want to do. But then, and again, the exact timeline I'm not entirely sure of, netbooks seemed to be the next step in this when the prices for PCs basically crashed through the floor. Mm-hmm. With netbooks.
Right.
And Apple critics said, well, this is the end of Apple. Apple is going to get priced out of the market. And so the Apple apologists congratulated themselves when the netbook phenomenon itself seemed to die. Mm-hmm. They said, oh, Apple is great for not having bought into that, not having gone into that trap. But they were still like really low-priced PCs, even when there were no longer netbooks. And so my impression is you can get, basically a full PC for like $400 or $300 or even $200.
Yep, yep.
And, by comparison, Apple still basically sells $1,000 computers. So Apple has never attempted to get down to that level with their hardware. And this is a bunch of years now. This is at least about 5-10 years that it's basically been at that level. Now, Apple apologists have always said that the criticism that Apple is only for luxury products is wrong. That Apple is, in fact, for the masses. And I believe that, too. And some of the reasons for that were, the laptop stuff, as I previously said. I thought that Apple prices were at least coming down competitively for a while. Also, the iPod, when it was first created, it was expensive. But the mass production of it, when Apple started selling more of them than anyone else was making of their products, Apple was able to actually make it cheaper than their competitors were able to make their iPods. Mm-hmm. And that was very encouraging to me. That said, well, okay, Apple stuff is expensive now, but they're going to get it to be less expensive when they start to make more. And also, Apple did reduce the price of the original iPhone as well. The iPhone originally started very expensive, and then they brought it down. And so some of those seem to be very, very encouraging to me, that Apple was going to continue to be competitive about being a mass market company. But then there were the retreat. So again, as I said, PC prices went down, Apple prices did not. It's interesting to see that the rumors that were there before Apple introduced the 5C, because there were a lot of rumors that Apple was finally going to introduce a cheaper phone with the 5C. And at that point, Apple was already getting lapped by cheaper Android phones. For a while there, when Android first came out, they were 50-50 or, 60-40. The latest that I read about was 80-20 now, which is, crazy. And so the hope was that 5C would finally be Apple taking that a bit more seriously. And it wasn't. The 5C was basically just a replacement for where the 5 would have been in that lineup. Mm-hmm. That instead of the 5 moving down to being the slightly cheaper phone, they made a new 5C. Same hardware in a different package, in a different case. And then, is anyone really surprised when that didn't sell that well? That if you're basically still talking an expensive product, and you're only getting the people who can buy an expensive product to buy it, well, then they're going to go for the even more expensive one that has the better hardware in it. And you might think, well, that was only $100, right? What's wrong with that? Well, that's in the U.S., for our U.S. listeners. Of course, it's still, $500, $600 in absolute dollars in the U.S., which means it's very expensive in the rest of the world, where you have more income disparity. You have a class of rich people and many, many more people who are much poorer than that throughout the world. And more of those people can buy, maybe $100 Android phones or $200 Android phones than could buy $500 Apple phones. And the last step, and of course the most recent step, is the watch. And the watch really started to make me rethink, because in a lot of ways, I was still thinking, well, maybe Apple's still trying. Maybe Apple will still try, will still lower prices on things. Maybe they'll eventually come out with a lower cost iPhone. But the watch seems to be the first time, and there's a lot of things different about the watch, but it seems to be the first time in my recollection that Apple is explicitly moving into a luxury market. Previously, they would make good computers or good phones that were expensive because they were good. Now, they're making devices that are explicitly made to be sold to people who can pay more for them only because they can pay more for them.
Hmm.
You know, solid gold phones, watches, all this other stuff that they're doing now. And it worries me. And it worries me for a couple of reasons. One is the economic dimension. The luxury market is small. It's been interesting to me hearing all these people, all these different pundits, Apple pundits, talk about the fact that Apple's going for the luxury market as if it were just another thing. And Apple will go for it and they will make lots of money for it and they will be great. Well, no. If Apple is truly concentrating on this market of people who make a shit ton of money, there just aren't as many of those people.
Almost by definition.
By definition. So if they're really concentrating on them instead of kind of, you know, maybe starting expensive and gradually lowering for everyone can buy it, they will make less money. They will not be as big a company as they are now if they keep doing that. Now, you can't talk economics here without kind of talking about the larger economic situation in the world. Apple certainly can't solve all of the world's economic ills. I talked about income disparity in the rest of the world. Well, income disparity in the U.S. is growing. As far as I'm not an economist. From what I've been reading, this has been an issue in the U.S. for the last decade or so. More so than in previous decades. My understanding of America's history is that, you know, the middle class grew at the end of the Second World War in a way that was fairly unique to our history, to the world's history. And that now that middle class is shrinking now for reasons that politically people can argue over. I read an article a while ago about how restaurants are changing. Restaurants that focused on the middle class were doing worse than restaurants that focused on really cheap food versus really expensive food. And, you know, so many companies are adapting to this or trying to adapt to this. And I did wonder when I read that, you know, what's Apple going to do about this? Apple makes a lot of money. Apple's a mass company. They're going to have to change with the economy. Well, so it's a bit disappointing to see that Apple, instead of saying, well, you know, people are making less money, therefore maybe we could try to put some of our vaunted product design skills towards making phones that they can afford. Instead, they're saying, well, no, those people can't afford our stuff anymore. Now we're going to go for the really rich people. That seems to be what's happening. It almost seems too neat, right? Like, is that really all they're thinking? How could they do that? And it also seems self-defeating. But that's what I'm seeing now. And I tweeted about this. I'm really surprised that people aren't mentioning this otherwise. That Apple may, you know, they still make other products, but the fact that their focus is going to be basically rich people, I'm uncomfortable with that. And, you know, people have talked about, well, how their stores are going to react to this. You know, they'll need new stores or change stores to deal with the fact that basically just rich people are going to go there to buy rich people stuff. Because right now the stores are really very mass market. Anybody can come in. They're often very crowded. You know, you can't have that environment if you're going to want to target people who to sell $5,000 watches to. What are they going to do about that? So the transition is not done yet. Obviously, they haven't even started selling the watches yet. I will be curious how much more they transform themselves and what they lose as part of that. Can they be these two companies at the same time? What is the long-term ramification? And of course, developers are going to have a problem with this as well. We're already at 80-20. Are we going to be at, you know, 5-95 like we were with Windows, with Apple not caring because they're just making all this money off of a tiny segment of the population? That's going to be pretty bad for us as engineers, and it will eventually be bad for Apple as well. We've talked about that before, so I won't go into it again. But that's what I've been thinking about recently.
Well, so. I will say that there is a precedence of Apple doing this. Do you remember the 20th anniversary Macintosh?
Oh, come on. That was a one-off. That was not policy.
It was designed by a furrier, Johnny Ive.
Okay, title. Yeah, but this is them betting the company on this.
Yes and no. I agree that yes, it's kind of, they obviously are entering the high end, selling to rich people with a force there, and I think it might change Apple in perhaps fundamental ways that might be good, but I think probably you're right. It'd probably be altogether not great. But I almost view it as, I don't want to call it a loss leader because that's definitely not what it is, but it's a similar thing. I think that it's like the 20th anniversary of Macintosh. It's a hood ornament. It's the high end solid gold iWatch is, you know, the concept car or something. I don't know. It's like it's something out there where that Apple puts out saying this is the best of this version. And maybe they modify the Apple stores to better support it or whatever. Maybe they don't. Maybe it's something. I mean, 20th anniversary Macintosh.
Well, they can't. They can't
have the stores delivered to you, right?
The stores can't. They can't make the stores both a high end boutique and what they are now. I don't know how they're going to do it. I would be very interested in finding out.
Yeah, I agree. This is definitely an interesting retail angle here. Mm-hmm. But I also agree with you that this is not going to be, you know, where Apple's game make its most money. It's things like the iPod and the iMac and, you know, these mass consumer things that really are what brings home the bacon.
What makes them the biggest company in the world.
Exactly, right. And so I view this more as a marketing strategy that is not really. I'm worried how what it will do in terms of changing perceptions of what Apple is. But I think they've thought this stuff through a lot, and I think they're just trying to make it maybe put more of a spotlight even on the consumer models, just by knowing people will know there's a $20,000 Apple Watch out there. Like, oh, you have an iWatch. Oh, is that the $20,000 one? No, it's not, because they barely sell any of those. But the fact that you can have something that's similar to a $20,000 Apple Watch, to me, it doesn't make a lick of sense, but I don't care about this stuff, and I'm not who they're
targeting this. I've seen how you dress. Yeah. Well, and you know, me too, right? Yeah, we're not going to be fashion people. But,
So there's some sort of marketing psychological games here that I don't fully understand, and I'm also worried about kind of the precedence it sets, but I think it's actually a blip on the radar. I don't think it's as serious as you make out to be.
All right. Well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. And we'll see you next time.